Blog Talk Radio.
Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie ahead and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic, and I don't know if we're past the statute of limitations, but Happy New Year.
I think we're getting close, but hey, I'll take it. I'll take it. Sort of like today, I there's the good luck food you're supposed to eat on New Year's Day, right? There's cabbage, and and you know, black-eyed peas, and I believe ham, right? And you know, today at lunch, I had two of those things. So, you know, I was thinking, well,
okay, so, you know,
to get the good luck.
Make some resolutions.
Exactly.
You know,
that's
last
right.
Last night, stay up till midnight, you know, just whatever you want to. Why not? Why not ring it in on the 14th? I don't, you know,
Different cultures, you know, there's the Chinese New Year. It's going to be on, you know, so, hey, you know, the Stephen New York.
That's right. This is January 1st. Oh, no, excuse me. This is the beginning of the world transformed year, if you will.
There you go.
So. Actually, I believe our year starts back in October, right? Because that's where we count our anniversaries. But anyhow, we haven't had a show since before the holidays, so it's good to be back. Good to be talking with you again. How were your holidays? Nice time had?
Oh yeah, had a good time with the family and kind of stuck close to the house around Christmas time and you know, I did the family thing at Christmas time and then you know, celebrate with friends and. And open it up around New Year's, and just have a good time all around.
Great way to do it.
How about you?
Nice.
How about you and
it.
Your family?
Well, we did the family thing. Had some family medical issues going on right around Christmas, so that kind of put a bit of a monkey wrench in the works. But still, it was a nice time all the way around. And then after Christmas, the whole family, we all went to Disneyland for a few days. So that was kind of nice. And we actually rung in the New Year at Disneyland, so that was a fun experience with the little kids and also with the older child whom I've taken to Disneyland before. Actually, when I say child, you know, she's my child, but she's, you know, pretty much a grown person, of course. Still enjoys going on Pirates of the Caribbean with her dad.
You're good for that. That's great.
Exactly. Observation about Disneyland, you know, because I've been to Walt Disney World once. And now I've been to Disneyland twice. And, of course, the place I'm always most excited to go is Tomorrowland, right? I always want to see, well, now what's happening in the future this time? And it's always a disappointment. I mean, there's cool stuff going on there, but in terms of really being dialed into the future, not so much. But
it's a path. You're looking at Tomorrowland is a vision of the future as seen from the 50s or 60s, you know?
Well, now it is. I mean, they sort of in the late 90s started playing it up that way, right? Because they're like, well, we're never actually going to get ahead, so let's turn it back and make it kind of a... So architecturally, it's very much a past future.
Right.
Inside the pavilions, they had some interesting House of the Future stuff going on, sponsored by, I don't know, DuPont or 3M or someone like that. But the main floor of Tomorrowland has really become Marvel Comics land, and that was kind of cool. So that was where we got to meet Captain America and we got to meet Thor. Anybody who gets a chance to go to Disneyland, I recommend take the time, go to Tomorrowland and meet Thor. Okay, because that is you actually go on this little trip to Asgard, and it's.
That sounds like fun.
Of all the meeting characters, things that was by far the best. But I got a picture of my three.
Boy was just I just loved that. I bet you he thought that was great.
Well, you know, it's like you're 3 years old. You just take it all as read. It's like, oh, okay. Well, now I finally get to meet Captain America face to face. You know, it's like
about time. Exactly. Yeah, I've been you know, you've been holding out on me, Dad.
Been holding out on me, but now I get a chance to do that. Yeah, I mean, to him, it's like, well, this kind of stuff obviously happens all the time. But I got a picture of my three youngest, each one standing in front of a different Iron Man suit. And you would like it, Stephen. I think you would really get a kick out of it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm a huge Iron Man fan. I'd probably be geeking out as much as your three-year-old boy, I'm sure.
Well, in fact, there's a game there. We didn't get to play it, but there's an attraction, I don't know what to call it. It's not a ride, where you basically you stand in front of a blue screen, and then you don suit, and they're showing an animation of the suit, but it's basically it's doing everything you do. So you're like, you've become Iron Man. Looks like it.
Oh, man.
It was a lot of fun.
That sounds like fun.
But you're only allowed to do it for so long. I'm just going to tell you right now, Stephen. They do make you stop.
That'd be like, sir, there's a line in,
there's a lot of children here who'd like to try.
A lot of children. Make them wait. Yeah.
But
I promise you, I've been waiting longer to do this than those kids.
That's exactly right. But a lot of the things we think about in terms of the future. Just in terms of options that we have around kind of defining our own space and defining our own reality, Disney remains, the parks remain kind of a prototype for that, even today. And I feel like we're in many ways closer to some of that than we have been in the past. When you walk into Disney's California Adventure, the newer park, it's been around for quite a while now too, but the park that they made out of the old Disneyland parking lot, and it's you're basically in Main Street of a California city unnamed, because it's not any particular one, from somewhere between the 1930s to the 1950s. I think there are aspects of that whole era thrown in there. But just the sense that you've actually arrived someplace like that is overwhelming. You know, I mean, it's just, it's really pervasive and really convincing. And you look at that and you go, you know, I think we're going to see a lot more of that kind of thing. You read Substance of Style, books like that by Virginia Pastrell. She talks about how important that kind of look and feel of our environment is becoming as we become more technologically sophisticated and more able to control those kinds of variables. And I know Epcot was always described as what's that stand for? It's the Experimental Prototype City of Tomorrow. But I think if you
Community want to of Tomorrow, yes.
Excuse me, Community of Tomorrow. But if you really want to see the Community of Tomorrow, go visit Disney California Adventure. Not that we're all going to live in a California town of the 1940s, but just the ability to kind of create any reality you want to create. They've really nailed it down there. Plus, we got to meet Mater in person. So, I mean, it's just like.
That's awesome. That's so cool. Yeah, I definitely need to take my kids to that before too much longer. I've kind of been holding out on them, so.
Yeah, get down there. I mean, you guys are, you're not that close, but you're reasonably close to Walt Disney World, right? So you could.
Pretty much it's a plane ride to a Disney park either direction. You know, I mean, I'm in flyover country here, so I suppose I could drive to Florida to do it. And I have had friends who do, but you're going to lose a day and a half going one way.
Yeah, you're
going to
eat up a lot of your vacation time. That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
So pretty much get on an airplane either way.
Take the flight.
Yep.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yep.
You can see the ocean from up there too, since you can't actually.
Well, the thing about Disney though is Disney dreamed big, and I think that kind of plays into what we're going to be talking about tonight.
Nice little segue there. Well, okay, so let's get down to business. We are, after all, dealing with, I think. You know, we say we dare to take on the big topics, and every now and then we have to just stand up and prove it. And so our program tonight is called Dogs That Poop Money. Okay, I guess this is probably our most, certainly scatological and probably most irreverent title that we've ever done. So I feel pretty good about that.
Well, you know, if we are ever accused of taking ourselves too seriously,
let's point to this show.
Yeah, this show. You know, dogs for poop money. That's you know, we don't really take ourselves too seriously. So here
exactly.
We go.
Exactly. Well, I just, you know, I got to give Iowa Hawk credit for that. The image is not our own, but this comes back to a little Twitter spat from it's almost a couple of weeks ago now. It was January 3rd. Neil deGrasse Tyson, a prolific and prodigious blogger. In addition to all the man's other accomplishments, the guy cranks out, excuse me, Twitter. The guy cranks out a lot of tweets, okay? He is on Twitter a lot, and he's putting out a lot of stuff, and he seems to be interested in raising hackles occasionally with some of the things he puts out there, or just likes to make an impression, whatever. I haven't been terribly offended by anything he's put out there, and I think it's all in good fun. But he made this, I would have thought, fairly nondescript kind of, we can all agree with this sort of tweet. He wrote, Obama authorized North Korea's sanctions over cyber hacking. Solution there, it seems to me, is to create unhackable systems. And now, Iowa Hawk, whose actual name is David Burge, I had no idea. Did you know this guy had a name? I had no idea. You know,
I suspected when he was born he wasn't given the name Iowa Hawk, but beyond that, I didn't know.
I just figured he came out with the receding hairline, with the pipe, with the dog coming out of it. I don't know, just that's, you know, that's how I pictured it. But anyway, David Burge responds at Neil Tyson. Also, how about a new type of dog that poops money? Hey, I'm just an idea guy. You scientists work out the details. So an awesome response, you know. And by the way, speaking of prolific tweeters, is that the correct word, by the way? What do you call someone who tweets a lot? What do you call someone who's on Twitter all the time? Twitter user.
I think Twitter is fine.
Yeah.
I think that let's go with that tonight. If we can,
Iowa Hawk really
someone
talks, that, so.
You know, we'll stand corrected if somebody tells us different. But tonight,
yeah, you know, we never say this, but if you know the right word, call in 347-215-8972. Set us straight. Or let us know in the chat room, whatever you're more comfortable with. Or just tell somebody to tell us. However you want to handle it. Anyway, so Iowa Hawk, he's cranking out tweets all the time, but this one really caught my attention, first because it's one of the biggest laugh out loud moments I can ever remember having on the internet, because that is just such a perfect image, and just the whole like snark of it is just fabulous. And clearly what he's saying is, sure, you know, anybody can suggest some grandiose sounding goal, you know, that makes everybody happy, but you know, the real trick is to know how to do something, right? So,
right.
So in taking this, hey, I'm just an idea guy. You scientists work out the details. Basically, he's saying that Tyson's suggestion isn't worth an awful lot. You think that's a fair characterization?
Oh yeah. That's what he's saying. And you know what? I can see the. I can see the reason why he would, you know, say that, and obviously beyond just being funny, there's truth to it. An unhackable system. I mean, come on. I mean, basically, in order for a system to be unhackable, if you want an unhackable computer, remove it from the internet entirely. You know, I mean, if you're going to have any kind of connection with others, which, by the, you know, is pretty much, you know, computers these days, that's what computers do, you know.
Right.
Was a time when I had a glorified word processor that was, this was prior to me even knowing what the internet was when I went to college in 87, right? And, you just used it to type your term papers, right? The days of that kind of computer are over. What computers are useful for is being a part of a network, and just the act of being part of it means that you're vulnerable. And the only way to completely avoid being vulnerable is to not be a part of that. And so that's a price that's higher than any of us want to pay. So we just deal with it when we are hacked, basically, is what it comes down to, and do our very best to protect ourselves. But otherwise, just deal with it.
One of the other tweeters who responded to Tyson's tweet, said, while we're at it, why don't we just develop unbombable cities and unkillable people? You know, another very worthy goal, right? But also another one that's like, definitionally, you wonder, well, is that even possible? Is it possible for there to be an unkillable person? Is it possible for there to be an unhackable system? At some point, you get into semantic arguments around these things.
You remember Jocelyn Elders? Jocelyn Elders took she was a Surgeon General underneath Bill Clinton, and there was a lot of laughs that were had at her expense when she suggested that what we needed was safer guns and safer bullets. And you know, I mean, the whole point of a gun is, you know, is to be dangerous in the right way. Controlled danger, I guess. You know, if a truly safe gun would not be a gun anymore. But I was reminded of that in reading about this. So
yeah, well, there you go. I mean, it's like there's an interesting idea. There's a kernel of an idea there, but definitionally, you run into issues. You run into issues when you start talking about a completely unhackable system. But at the same time, I want to challenge that idea just for a moment.
Sure.
Some people have responded and said, well, the only way you could have an unhackable system is to have it accessed by no one, right, including, you know, the people who ostensibly would need to use it. And it seems to me, well, okay, that would be one way, right? If absolutely no one can access the system, it can't be hacked. Others, you know, talking about just the general principle, point out that the less hackable a system is, the more likely it is to be experiencing downtime, right? The more likely it is to either not be working or to be completely off the network. And I understand that philosophically we might be in a place where you can say, look, as long as there's someone who can get into that system and there's another human being on the planet who can hold a gun to that person's head and make them get in and do what they want, you're right, there's no such thing as an unhackable system. Okay.
Correct.
I actually have an answer even to that. I think I figured out how we can have unhackable systems. I've been thinking about this for 2 weeks, so I think I've got the answer, but we'll come back to it.
Okay.
I want to work up to it, because even if the idea of a fully unhackable system is a wild goose chase, the idea of a predominantly unhackable system is not, right? I mean, we all agree that that we don't want them to be hacked. We want them to be as hard to hack as they can possibly be.
Right.
That we want there to be a reasonable assurance that they won't be. When we look at what happened at Target, what was that, a year ago, about a year and a half ago?
It was last Christmas.
Last Christmas. When you look at what happened to Target, whether that system could have been made fully unhackable, when you read the diagnosis of how it happened, you can look at that and go, well, that could have been prevented, right? Somebody could have thought of that and stopped that from happening. I don't know if you've read like the whole story about how they got into there, but it was an unexpected backdoor through an HVAC company, a company that was monitoring temperature levels in Target stores, and they just happened to be sitting there on the same network as everything else, including the point of sales system and, you know, everything with all the credit card numbers and all that stuff. So all they ever ended up having to do was get the credentials of someone inside that company, and suddenly, you know,
which probably
they were
easy to do by comparison to getting to the
compared to actually getting a login to the Target stuff, it was much easier to do. And that was a system that every day was sending out a little bit of data, right? It was sending out temperature data and stuff like that. So they just doubled it or whatever, and nobody ever even noticed, right? It was just sitting there every day sending temperature data to one place and a few credit card numbers. Yeah, someplace else, right?
And when you said few credit cards, you meant thousands of credit card numbers.
Yeah, a few thousand credit card numbers. All right, exactly. You know, it was. But slowly but surely, it didn't do everything at once. It operated under the radar once they had it up and running. But if you look back, that was a fairly, if not obvious, a fairly discoverable and preventable potential area of breach there. That vulnerability could have been prevented. And I think when you see any of these big cases where this has occurred, it happened with one of the big gaming systems. It's happened with another retailer or another financial institution. I can't think who it was. But by the time they diagnose those, you always look at those and go, well, okay, that one they could have fixed. So maybe the fully unhackable system is a pipe dream. But I think the predominantly unhackable system, and anyway, the system that isn't hacked by any of the ways that are currently happening or that we're probably currently at risk for, that is doable, right? That is probably
right.
Something that that we should be working for.
And, you know, compartmentalize the most important things, you know. That would have helped, you know. Your hacker under those circumstances might have been able to adjust the temperature in your stores and make it uncomfortable for your shoppers, but couldn't steal their credit card numbers had they been compartmentalized, right? So,
right.
So anyway, hindsight's 20/20, but maybe going forward, they probably have implemented that to keep you know.
I'm sure that they have had a complete overhaul. Yeah.
Of that. You know,
and
you no longer get all systems just because you're hacked into one.
Right.
A target, I'm sure. So.
Right. Well, and it wasn't really that they were into all systems. They were just on a network with the other one, and there was nothing stopping them from getting into it. You know, it was just a matter of sharing pipe, right? That nobody ever thought about the risk there, the danger there. I don't think we've heard yet exactly what happened at Sony, where the breakdown occurred, or how it. At least I haven't read anything.
I'm not sure that they'd know now. You know, exactly how it happened and exactly who did it. You know, I mean, North Korea has been blamed, but I've heard quite a bit that it might not have been North Korea. So I don't know. We'll see.
There is a lot of really interesting speculation to that effect. I have this feeling, this is just me, I have this feeling that the FBI went on the record saying it was North Korea because they have pretty good reason to believe it's North Korea, and it's above and beyond what we've seen, right?
Right.
I could be wrong there,
one thing we do know about North Korea is that their, you know, cyber hacking military branch or whatever has like doubled or tripled in size in the last year. You know, they've put a lot of resources into being able to do exactly what was done there. So, you know, and maybe, you know, because they didn't like that particular movie, you know, best advertising campaign ever for a movie, by the way.
For a movie that might not have been that.
It would never
that big of a hit, anyhow.
I mean, it had you know bomb written all over it, in my opinion. But now everybody's seen it. So that's way to go, Kim Jong. You know, I mean, that's
well, exactly. On the Golden Globes the other night, I don't know if you saw it, Tina Fey said that hats off to North Korea for making us all pretend like we wanted to see that movie.
exactly.
Put us into that position. So to me, I think that there are two kind of equal and opposite things that can happen if you try to create the fully unhackable system, right? The one is that you never get very close to that, and you end up with a system that's still just totally laced with vulnerabilities because you were going, you know, you've allowed the perfect to be the enemy of the good, right? And then you never end up with the working system. On the other hand, depending on how you approach it, depending on how you go about it, the effort to create one that's completely unhackable might get you closer than just organic efforts will, or it might get you there faster. There might be a big paradigm shift, a big aha moment, as you start completely rethinking how you go about doing it. So, I completely buy into the snark. I think the snark's important because it is a lot easier to suggest something like that than it is to do something like that. It's almost infinitely easier to suggest a new idea than it is to execute an idea. But I don't think that means that suggesting the idea is not a good idea. I think that's the difference. Even something that, it just sounds like somebody's being glib when they put something out there. You know, if it gets people to react, if people start responding to that and say, well, you can't do it because blah, 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 and then someone else says, well, but maybe you could, and there's a conversation taking place, I think that's valuable. If for no other reason, that's probably a good reason to come up with something like that.
I love that it's Neil deGrasse Tyson, okay, that this is, you know, that has this little bit of almost a controversy about it. The irony is thick, and here's why. On the Nerdist podcast a little while back, he kind of, well, not kind of, he came out completely against philosophy as a discipline, okay? And, you know, and stated, you know, his irritation with asking deep questions that lead to pointless delay in progress, okay? I'm not kidding. That, you know, go
that
check out the
funny.
Nerdist podcast. It's hilarious because, you know, here he is basically suggesting something that's not really practical. And, you know, I love dreaming big. I think that that's an important part of getting there. You know, let's not forget Arthur C. Clarke's, you know, law, right? I think it's his second law. The only way of discovering the limits of the possible is to venture a little further into the impossible, right?
Right.
And so, you know, you got to push up against the impossible and find out, oh, maybe that was on the border is turns out to really be possible. And, oh, yeah, we can launch satellites and set up a communication network. That's cool. So that's, you know, that's kind of Clark's way of looking at the world. And that and the way we get there is, you know, to ask the big questions and ask the stupid questions and the silly questions, right? Because what turns out to be, you know, what looks like a silly question or a stupid question when first asked becomes the, you know, the prophetic, you know, genius question, you know, a few years down the road. So, but yeah,
I heard a comedian a while back on Comedy Central was talking about these platitudes you hear, and one of them is there are no stupid questions. He says, yeah, you hear that in the business world a lot of time. You know, there's no stupid questions, there's no stupid questions. Listen, whoever came up with that doesn't have kids, okay? but in fact, there are no stupid questions. The dumbest idea you can throw out there could be, oddly enough, two or three iterations away from an idea that really might do something. It might not even be impacting the area that you think it's going to impact, but it could touch upon something that gets something going. That's why I spent a little bit of time and thought about this. Could we come up, Stephen, could we come up with a new type of dog that poops money? What do you think?
Well, I think that we should because, you know, I'm going to tell you that what comes out of the, you know, the back ends of my dogs is, you know, it's not valuable. It's the opposite of valuable. You know, it's something that has to be disposed of, and it's of not, you know, of no social utility at all. So, yeah, I think that's something we need to do, right? And by the way, it's not the I have to disagree with the Iowa Hawk. It's not the scientists that would do it. It would be the engineers, right? You know, the scientists tell us what's possible or impossible, and the engineers would actually give us the money pooping dogs. So
perhaps the scientists would give us the theoretical basis, and then the engineers would build a dog.
Yeah, here's how we do it.
I think we're kind of at that stage because I agree with you completely. Okay, let me just on a personal note here. Okay, this is a reality I deal with every day. All right, I have two dogs, and this is. Somehow, I don't know why, it wasn't even my idea to get the dogs, but somehow this is my job, okay, that I have to deal with this. And let me tell you, this is the worst time of year for it. Yeah. Partly it's not so bad because things tend to freeze, which actually helps, but we've got snow in the backyard. And so we've got stuff lodged in the snow, you know, and it's like sometimes you have to, like, really break it because it's gotten icy during the day when things have warmed up. And I'm sorry if this is too graphic for everybody, but this is reality I'm talking about here, okay?
Yes.
So it's like you're really going to all this
still
effort, and for what?
World.
Yeah, you know? Why am I going to this effort? So I can put this in a bag, which then goes into a larger bag, which eventually goes into the trash. And, you know, to your point, Stephen, there's nothing but downside to dog poop, okay? There's absolutely nothing but downside to dog poop. And I would be ecstatic, okay, with a dog that, you know, popped out a $10 bill, or even, shoot, a quarter, right, every time.
Yeah.
I mean, that'd be worth going out in the yard for. I if it's lodged in the snow, I don't care. I'm fine with that.
Hey,
even
if what came out of them was a completely neutral thing, what if it was just more snow? I mean, that would be great.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something that wouldn't have to be disposed of. But
mulch would be ideal, because then I'd just have to go rake it once a week or something. Right? Just kind of rake it in a little bit. That would be perfect, you know. Money would be great, because then the kids, they'd actually go pick that up, right?
Yeah,
I wouldn't even have to
do anything. It wouldn't be your problem anymore. Yeah.
It would no longer be my problem. That's right. But it doesn't have to be money. Any alternative to what we currently have is good. So if, in fact, that silly question, that silly, snarky remark by Iowa Hawk were to lead someone to say, hey, you know, well, I don't think we can make them poop money, but we could make, you know, somehow genetically engineered dogs so that they produce something more like mulch, that would be awesome, you know. Now, I'm not suggesting, you know, for anyone about to freak out on me here, I'm not actually suggesting we genetically experiment on dogs or anything like that. We're just talking theoretically here. And, you know, if you could provide additional health benefits to dogs in addition to the fact that that they'd be pooping mulch, then I'd be all for it. But anyhow, I really think you could make it
happen. Do something for the poor, you know, bulldogs. Those guys are, you know, terribly inbred. You know, do something for them.
Yeah, absolutely.
While you're fixing them where they're pooping money, do something where they have a, you know, higher quality of life, right? So,
but I believe right at the convergence of nanotech and biotech, down the road, okay, it would be possible. It would actually be possible to put dog food in one end of the system and get money out the other end of the system. I think that actually could be made to happen, assuming, you know, we have the kind of technology that we believe we will have at one point. Then you run into the philosophical definitional problems. It's like, well, okay, would it really be money? Wouldn't that be counterfeit? You'd have to actually have a whole legal structure whereby this product that comes out of dogs would be money. So ultimately,
well,
I
wasn't taking it literally. I was taking this as, you know, not literal dollars, just bills, quarters and
yes.
stuff. Yeah. No, it's something
yeah.
worth something.
Sure, they could poop gold. You know, that's kind of out there. That'd be kind of hard to make that happen.
Yeah,
something along those lines. Yeah, fine collectibles. I don't know what they're. basically, your dog becomes a 3D printer, right? You put dog
yeah.
food in, and
yeah, or,
figurines come out. I don't know. In any case, you could make it happen. You could make just about any physical substance the product of a process that has just about any input, given the kinds of technology that we're eventually talking about. But that's so far down the road. And it's so absurd to begin with. It's like, well, I can't really see that's an idea that's going to go much of anywhere. But I thought it would be fun if we'll spend the rest of our time, since we've spent about half our time on unhackable systems and dogs that poop money, if we just talked about a few other ideas, you know, because we're kind of in that business. We're putting a book together, which is just people giving their great ideas for how to make the world a better place. So, wait, is our book just so much dogs that poop money? What do you think, Stephen?
I think, you know, by and large, our the ideas that are dealt with in the book are a little closer to reality than the money pooping dogs, I got to say. You know, my little part of the book, I talked about, you know, auto drive cars. And that's already in some ways a reality. It's just, you know, in the future's here, it's just not evenly distributed, right? So,
right.
But, you know, it's something I look at you know, 10 years from now, a world is going to be a much different place, because cars will be taking a lot of the load off the drivers, if not completely by that point. It'll be, you know, typical, I think, for cars to do all the interstate driving by that, you know, within 10 years. And
right.
That's, we're going to find that, I think ultimately we'll find that machines drive a whole lot better than we do. We just, we have eyes that are pointed in one direction only. We're easily distracted. We're, you know, we get tired. We get emotional. We get drunk. and we make four drivers just overall. Whereas these machines won't blink and they'll look in all directions. And so, yeah, that's something that's just, it's, you know, I think it's inevitable and it's coming, and that's my part of the book. Phil, tell us about a little something about what you're talking about and what you're writing about.
Well, in the book, my chapter, I did a show on it a while back, is called A Matter of Days, and it's just a methodology for counting our lives in days. So, in fact, my idea is fully doable. It's just a suggestion for how people could organize their lives and could manage their time in a way differently than they do. So, in fact, mine is not terribly speculative in that sense. It's not like saying, hey, let's have a system that can't be hacked. It's saying we think about the world this way. Now let's think about it this way for a while. And I do have suggestions about you know, how we could involve technology in this and in different ways to make it more meaningful and to kind of drive it home better. But I guess I exempt mine from even being accused of being a money pooping dog because it's technologically already feasible, right? I mean, it's a thing. It's a thing you can already do, and that's kind of the beauty of the book, is that we pull possibilities from the present and the future in terms of where we are technologically. And I think the question I would give back to you, Stephen, about self-driving cars. Okay, well, they're not you know, money pooping dogs, but are they a system that can't be hacked? Because I think there are a lot of people who would probably say they are. That it's another kind of a technological pipe dream. It's easy for you to say, that there are so many obstacles and roadblocks to that it will never actually happen.
Well, I think one of the things that will make these cars so good at not running into each other is that they will be in communication with one another. Okay, my car, it can safely drive right up against the bumper of the car in front of it because it's in communication with that car, and it knows how much distance it has between the car in front of it. Maybe you get a whole convoy of cars like that, and they're in constant communication, so they can just, you know, zoom down the highway without the 2-second rule being in place, you know. And so, maybe even you're approaching an intersection inside of your hometown there, and you know, you don't stop. There's no red light anymore. You just shoot right on through. And why is that? Because it's your vehicle is in communication with all other vehicles, and it knows nothing is coming the other way. And so it's all, you know, it's always a green light, unless there's a car that's going to, you know, collide into you. And you only stop because you have to stop to keep from being a collision. And so that's the kind of, so I guess in a roundabout way, what I'm saying is this: in order to be in communication with other vehicles, you will be vulnerable. And so, you know, you've got to build systems that are hardened against hacking, so as to keep people safe. And can they be 100% foolproof? No, I don't believe so. Will it be safer than driving today? Oh yeah. No, I think by order of magnitude it'll be safer. But it's
not to spoil it too much, but your whole essay is predicated on the idea that numerically it's a lot safer. I mean it becomes worthwhile pretty quickly.
You don't have to have anywhere near a perfect system to be better than what we got now.
Exactly.
Because, again, we're not that great at driving. It's just not.
Here's the other distinction I would make between your idea and the two that are kind of our headliners for tonight. That I know of, no one is actually trying to build the purely unhackable system. And I'm ready to bet money that no one is currently trying to make dogs poop money. Okay, I don't think that there are any projects undergoing, you know, real work on that. Self-driving cars is a thing that major organizations are working to make happen. Car makers are working to make it happen. Google is working to make it happen. This is something that is a goal and that it is being pursued. So I think it definitely has more real world credibility to it than a lot of just purely speculative ideas might.
Well, you know,
a lot more ground.
10 years ago, a self-driving car would have been on par with a money pooping dog. You know, I mean, it's these things. Again,
or maybe a purely unhackable system. I think maybe 20 years ago.
Perhaps so, but it's and you know, things get as things change. We begin to see what's possible. We're able to distinguish a little differently from how we were a few years ago. What's possible and what's impossible. The lists of the possibilities change over time, don't they? And it goes back to Arthur C. Clarke again. You know, you always have to test it.
Right.
And so, you know, thinking of the SpaceX and their attempt, and it was unsuccessful this weekend to bring back the first stage of the rocket that sent a capsule to the space station. You know, it was a good try. They just didn't quite land it the way they wanted to, and so they lost that stage. It actually struck the platform they were trying to land it on. I think they ran out of fuel at the last second. But good try, right? That's they're butting up, you know, against what is possible and what is impossible. And I suspect that they're going to adjust things a little bit and keep trying until they get this thing down. So
there was a time when somebody writing a short essay such as would be acceptable as a contribution to our book on starting a private space program, would have been as speculative as anything we've talked about tonight, right? For someone to suggest doing that would have been, you know, crazy, that's easy for you to say, talk is cheap, kind of thing to do. And yet, somebody had that idea, and now SpaceX exists. So once in a while, those ideas that are totally out there and totally unrealistic and easy for you to say, whoever you is in that instance, make it all the way. One of the reasons that we divided the content requirements for The World Transformed, the abridged edition, into two categories is that we knew that we wanted there to be more than just great ideas. So for the longer essays, we asked people not only to describe a great idea, but also to give kind of the first step. How would you go about implementing this thing that you're talking about doing? How would you make this real? You know, they don't have to actually solve the problem in an essay, but at least give it that much grounding towards somebody doing something, such that somebody might read it and say, hey, you know, that does sound like a workable first step. I don't know if I can do that whole thing, but maybe I can do this part of that first step, and it actually spurs a little bit of action. So about half the content in the book is, or I should say about half the chapters in the book is going to be those kinds of things. And then the other half is just pure, you know, why don't we make unhackable systems, right? Just pure ideas that need to be communicated. And the great thing is those ideas can be developed into the ones that have that hook. They can be developed into the ones that have the first step. And an idea that has a first step, well, someone can actually take that and begin executing it. So there really is a process here. There really is a spectrum that even the craziest ideas, I think, sit on, and sometimes they become reality.
You know, imagine, you know, some super crazy idea where that someone
I got one.
Meat
grown on trees. Meat grown on trees. What do you think?
Okay. Let's imagine that someone actually pursues that and finds out that, you know, it's just really not practical.
Right.
But along the way, you know, they're going to learn some things that are practical, that are useful, right? I mean, you can't hard if you really got into that and studied it and were serious about it and pushed genetic engineering in that direction, you would learn some things that would ultimately result in some practical and awesome things. Yeah, I mean, just you could hardly help but find something cool, right? I mean,
absolutely.
And you may never get the quarter pounder on the tree, but
it should really be a vine, right? A tree is never going to cut it, but a vine. You know, you know what I mean. It could be something like it could be that no, it turns out the vat's the right way to go, and it should all be in a lab. But the, you know, this genius who has this idea, no, we're going to have rich orchards of, you know, prime rib, basically growing up, you know, blossoming on these trees. Yeah, I think you would make, you would to try to implement that, you would have to do groundbreaking work in, you know, gene splicing and genetic engineering, and who knows what kind of what kind of discoveries could come from something like that. And who knows,
you'd probably have to develop equipment. You'd probably have to develop lab equipment that would be used by somebody else to do something awesome at some point. You know, I mean, it's a truly ambitious goal that turns out to be, you know, that's just really not practical. Therefore, we're not going to ever really do that. But you know what? We can we do these other things now, and then, you know, and that's great. But there's also we keep hearing about the things that the space program brought us. You know, I mean, because, you know, we choose to go to the moon. Well, by doing so, there were benefits, there were dividends for making that effort, and you know, I believe that the integrated circuit was not, you know, developed for the it wasn't invented for the space program, but it was certainly, you know, it was certainly used by the space program, and that got that industry rolling, I think, a little better. So that's just one example.
Okay, I got a few more. I got a few more I'm going to throw out there, and you can we can evaluate. I'll tell you the truth. I've been writing these. Okay. When I'm trying to encourage people to write shorter entries for the World Transformed, I thought, well, one way I can demonstrate it, I'll come up with a few examples. And I decided, well, instead of just writing a few, I'll show that it's easy to do this. I'll write 50 of them. So I started writing 5 a day, and 10 days later, I had 50. And said, you know what? I think I can do 50 more of these. And then I wrote 50 more, and I had 100 of them. And I'm actually, by the end of the weekend, I'll be at 150 of these. And I don't know if there's an end in sight. I look at them now. I look back over some of the ones I've written, and I think, I wonder if that one's kind of a rehash of, you know, I wonder if number 128 is kind of a rehash of number 47 or something like that. But you can actually sort of build on them, and it's kind of a fun thing to do. Just coming up with ideas. You can't just come up with ideas. You have to do things too in the end. But it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun coming up with ideas. Here's one that I really enjoyed. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm just going to give titles of some of these, and you tell me what you think in terms of, you know, is this an unhackable system? Is this a dog that poops money, or is this a private space program? Okay. It's two words. Steven, you ready?
I'm ready.
Personal blimps. What do you think? Personal blimps.
Interesting. I would say certainly more doable than the dog that poops money, and probably easier to develop than a private space program. You know, what you're dealing with there is just and you know, a small lighter than air vehicle with a rigid infrastructure. You know, a blimp though doesn't have the rigid infrastructure. That's the difference, by the way, between a blimp and a dirigible. Okay.
Oh, see, now I got another one. Now I got 151.
Yeah, there you go.
Personable
there you go.
Airship.
There's a rigid,
right?
Infrastructure. Yeah, you know, inside of it that makes it hold its shape. That's
right.
That's no longer a blimp. So there you go.
You're right.
Can.
I should have said blimp. I was really thinking of zeppelins. You're right.
Yeah, that's a zeppelin or a dirigible or whatever. But
yeah.
It's that's I think it's doable. Is it something that would be practical for anybody but, you know, billionaires? Maybe not, but it'd be pretty awesome, though, wouldn't it?
It'd be pretty awesome. Well, I think if you started making them, I don't know, I think there'd be a nascent market for those. I really do. I'm not sure what the licensing requirement is around lighter than aircraft, whether it's harder or easier to get that license than it is an airplane, but I can just see a lot of guys of a certain age, or really any guy of any age, come to think of it, saying, yeah, I got to have one of those. I definitely need my own Zeppelin. You know, and once if you bought them, the price would start to go down. Okay,
I'm going to tell you what I'm going to tell you the practical aspect of that is that you need to fix it in some way that no ground crew is required.
That's right.
Because that's always been the limiting problem with blimps and lighter than aircraft like that is the requirement of a ground crew. You need to have somebody there to basically catch and hold it and bring it down. And you know, if you develop a way to keep from having to do that, you know, then you've gone a long way towards making that practical. Okay,
what you do is you make the ground crew robots. Okay. And in fact, now that we're synthesizing ideas here, let's start.
Let's jump off the blimp and land on the ground and catch the tethers. Yeah.
Exactly. Because, you know, they're robots. They're going to be okay if they got parachutes or whatever, or they'll just slide down a cable. But Let's combine your idea with my idea. Self-flying personal blimps. Okay, now you don't even have to have the license, right? So you've got Zeppelins. You've got your own airship. You got your own robot crew, and you don't even have to be able to fly.
You're basically a Bond villain
at this point. Okay, you are a James Bond movie villain at this point.
Rich guy from Contact?
Yeah, well, he was very Bond villain-like, yes. He was a Bond villain for good, yes. Okay, how about this?
Yeah.
Super sleep, okay? A process by which people can sleep for only 20 minutes, and it gives them the full 8 hours.
Oh, yeah, I'd love that. And I think that's actually doable to some extent. I think that... You'd be hard pressed to get the right amount of REM sleep that you'd need, but
could you be pumped with the right chemicals that the REM sleep is giving you or something? It's like, you know, is there some way to accelerate that whole process, or is there some way to basically tap your body off chemically in the same way that that sleep does? The real mystery around that one is we don't know exactly everything sleep does. You know, in some ways. There's still a lot of mystery around why exactly it happens. You know, there's theories as to why animals sleep, why humans sleep, but there's nothing definite about it. We know all kinds of health benefits associated with getting enough and all kinds of detrimental health consequences to not getting enough. But you'd need a lot more knowledge than we have now. I think neurological knowledge, biochemical knowledge, all kinds of things. And a better holistic understanding of what sleep is. But, yeah, I think something like that is probably possible in the end. In the end, we might have humans that don't have to sleep at all unless they want to, which
we
I would
already
still
have drugs,
think,
I think,
want to do.
I think the name of the drug is it Monopinil or something? It's something close to that.
Mm-hmm.
That you can take. And, you know, you can basically go 3 or 4 days without too many side effects, where you just, you know, you're not tired, you're not sleepy, you just, you know, you can operate for 3 or 4 days straight, and eventually, I mean, there's diminishing returns on that. You have to, at some point, you have to sleep, but in an emergency situation, that might be something that, you know, could be a life-saving drug. If you know, someone like a soldier or something needed to be able to operate like that for a short period
of
time.
Absolutely. Well, and you know, people who are on emergency rescue crews and things like that, there are times when that basic need becomes a real danger. Actually, people just driving on long haul trips and things like that.
You know,
the ability to stave that off is definitely
something. Hey, auto drive trucks will come.
That's right. That takes care of that. Once again, your thing impacts all the rest of these, Stephen. You had the one idea, and it hits them all. Okay, I'm gonna read a couple more without us commenting, because I'm gonna do one more that we'll talk about. Haptic blankets for VR dreams. Live-in gym. You basically live in the gym. I won't get into that one. There was one more I definitely wanted to hit. Oh, here it is. Anti-gravity shoes. What do you think, Stephen?
Oh, that's gonna be a hard one. For the same reason that artificial gravity, like you see on, USS Enterprise, you know, a non-rotating ship with gravity, you know, 1G gravity throughout the ship and it's not rotating and you're in space, you know, I think that would be that's going to be a tough one. We're going to have to understand physics a lot better than we understand it today in order to be able to do anything like that or our anti-gravity boots.
But once you have the thing that can do it, you just got to put it in shoes. So,
yeah,
there's
that's
just
right.
one big obstacle to overcome, and then you've got anti-gravity shoes. And
exactly.
I wasn't even thinking for, like, you know, flying. This is actually this. I wrote this one after walking around Disneyland all day, right? I was just thinking, you know, just give me like a 40%
reduction,
right?
Yeah, so that I can continue to walk, you know. Hey, and what a wonderful thing for people that are older or that have disabilities, you know, people that that would otherwise be in wheelchairs, you know, can get up and walk a little, you know. That would
disabilities, myasthenia gravis, for example, right, which is exactly that. It just makes you so weak that you can't walk around. Well, with an anti-gravity boot, you know, you crank it down to 10%, and those folks might be able to walk, or just people who are in rehabilitation from an accident, or you know, any of the other reasons. There's a lot of good applications for that if we could figure out how to
reverse
do it. The thing
for
is,
the rest of us, give us some exercise.
Yeah, well, exactly. Well, there you go. In fact, I've got weighted clothing in here someplace for exercise too. Once you get to 150, yeah, you've hit almost everything, I think. Now I'm going to see. I'll see how far I can go. You check in with me once in a while, and we'll see how we're doing on that. But that just goes to show you that there are a lot of possibilities out there, and I think it's a good idea to explore the possibilities. It's a good idea to say them publicly, and you know, even as Neil deGrasse Tyson did, perhaps subject yourself to ridicule, but possibly get an idea out there that. That really helps to make the world a better place. That's what our friends and we are doing with our book, and that book is underway, and it is going to be coming out sometime this year. I'm saying probably about the middle part of this year by the time we get it all put together. So we're looking forward to giving you more updates on that in the near future. And, Stephen, what's our music this evening?
Our music this evening is Constellations of She by Unquiet Nights.
Unquiet Nights with Constellations of She. That is compelling sounding music. I can't wait to hear that. And I'm sorry we talked so long now that I'm cutting into that music time. But everybody, if you're not listening live, be sure and listen to the MP3 to get the whole thing. Well, not next week, but 2 weeks from tonight, we're going to have Are You Serious and Jay Cornell on the show talking about their new book, Transcendence. So you will all want to be here with us for that. And until next time, live to see it.